When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media. With over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Welcome to Dressed, the History of Fashion, a podcast that explores the who, what, when of why we wear. We are fashion historians and your hosts, Cassidy Zachary
and April Callahan. Dress listeners, today's guest was described in the pages of Vogue in 1967 as, quote, the spirit of the hour, a walking fantasy, an elongated, exaggeratedly huge-eyed, beautiful doodle drawn by a wistful couturier searching for the ideal girl. She's also marvelous to talk to, funny, affectionate, interesting, and enthusiastic, knowing what she likes but diffident when she doesn't.
Likewise, one of the greatest fashion photographers of all time, Richard Avedon, once adoringly quipped of her, saying she is, quote, never only of today. To each gesture, she brings a sense of all the things that have ever interested her. Out of this, she invents every moment a new little role for herself, which she plays with devastating humor. She is a delight.
She certainly is. And today, dress listeners, we get to share that delight with you by being joined by one of the most iconic faces of fashion in the late 1960s and early 1970s, the one and only Penelope Tree, who blasted onto the pages of fashion magazines at the age of 17 in 1967 at the request of none other than Vogue editor Diana Vreeland. Quickly rising to the status of international jet set it girl, this period of Penelope's life during her late teens and early 20s is the inspiration behind her recently published first novel, A Piece of My Heart.
Exquisitely written and wistful, A Piece of My Heart is a fictionalized account of Tree's own meteoric rise to success and her passionate, tumultuous, and much publicized love affair with fashion photographer David Bailey. We cannot recommend adding it to your summer reading list enough, but we also should issue a trigger warning, dress listeners, that the novel and this episode of the show will briefly discuss the topics of eating disorders and sexual assault. So if these are sensitive topics to you, we wanted you, our listeners, of course, to know that in advance. And we cannot thank Penelope enough for being so raw and candid with us about these moments in her life.
Also, just a teeny tiny heads up, there was a little bit of slight static in Penelope and I's connection. So we've done our very best to correct it in the editing process. But alas, sometimes we are at the mercy of international internet connections, as Penelope was joining us from the UK.
And we are so glad she did. Penelope, a very warm welcome to Dressed.
Penelope, it is truly an honor to have you join us on Dressed today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I know that you actually rarely give interviews, so listeners, please know that this is an exceptionally special treat today that Penelope is going to join us to chat about her book, Piece of My Heart. And I could not put it down once I started reading. I think I finished it in the span of a day. And you become even more entranced by the story when you realize that a lot of the plot and a lot of the characters are actually based on your own life. So would you maybe give us a little bit of a teaser about the plot of the book and how this project came to be?
Project came to be because for years and years, I looked back over my much younger life, sort of coming of age years, and thought every time I looked at it, it seemed different. And I also felt quite a lot of residual pain from those years. And I thought, well, if I start writing about them, that will sort of uncover some of the source of the pain and I can deal with it then. And I've always wanted to write a novel. And the fact is that if I'd written a memoir, there would have been 4,000 characters and I had to cut down. So I kind of made a lot of composite characters. I set the whole thing in England, whereas I grew up in New York, actually. It would have been too complicated if I'd set the beginning in New York. And also, I came to various resolutions about things in the book that after, you know, when the book closes, which is when I was about 23, 24 years.
Yeah. And then it's one of the things that I found myself asking when I was reading the novel, you know, where does Ari, who is the main character, end, and where does Penelope begin, and vice versa? And maybe since you've already mentioned that you did grow up in New York, maybe we could start with some of those early overlaps between your life at home growing up, because Ari's parents in the book are very much modeled after your own parents. But as you have said, many of these details have kind of been changed.
Actually, my mother, for instance, is very much a complex character. She is not exactly the way my mother was at all. In the book, she is British and she's ambitious and she's working for a conservative cabinet minister in the House of the Parliament. And in reality, my mother was quite American. She was also ambitious and she was very much a Democrat. And yeah, there are many differences. And so I think that's quite important to make that clear.
Well, I mean, your family history is kind of the stuff that novels and television shows today are being built upon. You know, on your father's side, your life was kind of akin to Downton Abbey. Well, on your mother's side, fashion is literally in your blood, because I think it was one of your great-grandfathers was one of the founders of Marshall Field's, the noted American department store, if I am correct.
I think a cousin. My mother was also very interested in clothes, and one of the reasons I became so interested in fashion was that she was not a very maternal person. And so I had a nanny from really the moment I was born. But I got to see my mother every Thursday afternoon after lunch until sort of 6:30 or something. And she could never really kind of quite work out what to do with me. And from quite an early age, we'd go shopping down Madison Avenue and Saks Fifth Avenue and, you know, Bergdorf for her. But, you know, I really enjoyed it because it was the one time that we were together and you'd kind of try on all these clothes and come out and say, how do I look? And I'd kind of say, well, I love the red suit, but I'm not quite sure about the, you know, blue shoes. And she'd say, gosh, you've got such a good eye. And that made me feel very proud. And I think that's really where it comes
from. Yeah. Yeah, for certain.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, this moment, like in the 1950s and the 1960s in New York, must have been really, truly exceptional. Your life and Ari's life are full of this amazing cast of characters. And one of the things I was fascinated to learn is that, for instance, you were photographed at the age of 13 by the noted photographer Diane Arbus, who is, of course, one of the most important photographers of the 20th century. Was this kind of your first foray at that age of 13 into modeling or having your photo taken?
Yeah, Diane Arbus came and photographed me off a horse just after like 3 or 4 hours on a horse. It was incredibly hot. I had to lie in this grass. And she took 3 hours to take a photograph at the end of it. I was wearing one of those velvet and pictures were so hideous that my father refused to, you know, let her print them. So then she had to come back and do this other picture, which was also a very long process. And the reason I looked so pissed off and I was so fed up with standing there. She was an interesting person and we did have a connection. She took her time taking photographs.
Well, another fascinating person that was part of your life was Truman Capote. What may be described as your quote unquote big came a few years later in 1966. Would you tell us a little bit about your relationship with Truman? Did you know him previously before attending the Black and White Ball? And we'd also love to know anything that you want to tell us about that night.
I met Truman Capote when I was about 13. And being a sort of only child of my parents, my siblings, half-siblings were much older. So that meant I read an enormous amount as a child, because that's what you did. That wasn't allowed to watch TV. It was all a different time altogether. So I had read a lot of Truman Capote's early work, and I was absolutely in love with writing. And one day I was coming down and across the hall, a party going on, a lunch party. In particular, this voice, very campy, which I knew immediately was Truman Capote. You know, bided my time until lunch was called, and all the ladies, including Babe Paley, actually, who was there, swept into the dining room. And I went up to him and said, "I love your work." And he was really sweet about it. I mean, this is before the alcoholism had sort of, been, I guess. And he was really incredibly open and receptive. And he said, do you write? And I went, "Yes, I do." And he said, "I'd love to see what you write." And so I sent him the short story, and he sent me back a very sweet note, you know, saying, "Keep at it, kid," you know, sort of thing. And then we kept kind of this very small correspondence back and forth. And then I got, much to my huge surprise, I was so thrilled to receive an invitation from him to his Black and White ball.
I mean, the party of the century, perhaps.
Well, of the 20th century. Yeah. Well, it was the first time, I think, all the social world of Europe and America and, you know, Hollywood and intellectuals of New York, writers and even and politicians, Washington, they all came converged together in this ball. And that's what made it special, because that really, up until that point, I don't think that had happened before. That
blending
scale
of all the worlds. And of course, it was a costume ball with the dictate of wearing the colors black and white. Could you tell us about your spectacular ensemble that you wore that evening? And also, how did that come into being?
So I was in love with dancers at the time. So, I mean, I still am in love with ballet, modern ballet especially. And I love what dancers wore on and off the stage, their rehearsal gear and everything. And I went to see Betsy Johnson, who at that time was had just graduated from Pratt, and she was working for this fantastic store called Paraphernalia, which was sort of American answer to bebop. And together we devised this outfit that was based on dancewear, basically, which was made out of black silk jersey. It was very kind of cut away at the back with crisscross spaghetti strap and big slits up to my bust here, but, you know, to bra line. And yeah, it was just very simple, actually, with black tights underneath and black Capizio ballet slippers. So yeah, she did an amazing job. And when I looked at my reflection in the mirror when I went to try it on for the first time, I thought, this dress is going to change my life.
And it did. What happened that night?
Well, actually, that night, nothing much happened to me, because I was one of the youngest people. I think I was the youngest person at the ball, and was all about really me wandering around, observing people, you know, mostly these extraordinary headdresses with diamonds and feathers. And these ladies were very beautiful, often European royalty, meeting the New York socialites, and everybody going, "Darling, you look wonderful, wonderful, darling." And then there was Peter Duchin's band, which to me was quite oldies there. It was kind of Cole Porter and things like that, whereas I was into the Beatles and Stevie Wonder, of course. So it just seemed like another era to me. But there was amazing sight. Lauren Bacall dancing with Jerome Robbins. I saw a sort of fight breaking out between Norman Mailer and McGeorge Bundy, who was at the time the Secretary of State. They were arguing about Vietnam, and that was like thrilling to watch because there's really quite a lot of brio in there. Then also the family and the detective who tracked down killers of the Clutter family, they were there. And I was thrilled to see them because, of course, I'd read the book. And this detective was so clever to find the killers who were kind of itinerant boys. And the men were wearing Stetsons. The women were wearing very plain kind of clothes, almost daytime clothes. They really stuck out from the rest of the crowd. And, you know, so I was kind of on my own. And then out of the blue, Cecil Beaton came and dragged me onto the dance floor and we sort of waltzed for a couple of numbers on the dance floor. And I tried to sort of talk to him or entertain him in some way. And he just, as if he didn't hear me at all. He just went like, every time I tried to say something, he went, yeah, standing on the dance floor. And then at about 11:30, my father came, you know, to find me because we were going home. He always went to bed at, you know, by 12 at the latest. So I thought I was very disappointed and nothing had happened to me at all. I hadn't met Prince Charming or whatever. It was all, I was turning into a pumpkin before I even met Prince Charming. So I went to bed that night. I mean, it was spectacular spectacle. Yeah, it has to be said. It was, you know, great experience. It wasn't sort of, for me, very interactive. That's all. I was just an observer. The next morning, the phone rang at 9 a.m. sharp, and this voice came, very distinctive voice came down the line saying, "Darling, hello, Deanna Vreeland here from Vogue." And I went, "Oh, hello." And she said, "Dick Avedon saw you last night and wants you to do some tests for us. Will you do it?" And I went, "Yes, okay." Of course, I was thrilled, you know, terrified, all of those things. And about 5 days later, I found myself on the white paper, Dick Avedon studio, with his Rolleiflex centered on me.
So you were 16 at the time, which is amazing. When you first appeared in Vogue, would you tell us a little bit about that very first Vogue shoot? You also describe Ari's experiences with her first photo shoot in the book. So I'm wondering if there's a little bit of overlap.
No, there really isn't, because Ari's experience was with a sort of French photographer who was a bit of an amalgamation of Guy Bourdin and others. Whereas my experience was with Richard Apt. I was really frightened. But when he started shooting, just like in the book, some weird calm came over me and I suddenly sort of felt like I was connected with him in this quite, not a romantic way at all. I wasn't in love with him or anything like that, but I felt that we had some great connection and that I knew what to do, which was really unusual for me in those days because I felt very insecure about everything, of course, being seen. Kind of course, but I wasn't particularly academic or good at school. So, you know, finally to find something that I could do was very exciting.
And maybe you might speak a little bit about how you were initially received by the fashion world early on, because your look was so fresh and so new at that time.
The Vogue people, Polly Mellon and Deanna Vreeland and Richard Avedon and Vogue photographers really loved me. But when I went on Ghosties, the other companies, Madison Avenue, advertising agencies and companies, they just thought I was a joke. And they'd laugh in my face, like, "Who sent you? And who are you?" They could be quite sort of mean, actually. And I don't think that sort of thing would happen these days. But they'd say, you know, we asked for somebody pretty. What are you doing here?
It's a harsh world out there for the models still today, even if they're pulling some of those punches a little bit. It's a lot of rejection time and time again. I think some of our listeners might be surprised to know that in the 1960s and in decades prior to that, even top models like yourself, as you would go on to become, were sometimes expected to do their own hair and makeup on shoots. And I have to say, you are definitely one of the original makeup influencers. And I've read some other interviews that you have given where you said you first started pushing boundaries with cosmetics in your parents' social circles when you were just 13. So I would love to hear a little bit more about your teenage beauty insurrections and perhaps some of these very signature cosmetic looks that you helped popularize in the 1960s.
Well, I really wasn't aware that I was doing anything particularly advanced or anything. But when I was about 12 or 13 into adolescence, I was very rebellious, especially against my mother. And I decided that I would only wear black, apart from when I was reporting. I didn't have a choice, but the rest of the time it was black, everything. And then very pale. And, you know, it took a lot from what was going on in England at the time, pictures that I saw of, I guess, Mary Quant ads and also the Dolly Bird sort of look. And I think I did it really get attention, basically, at work. Mm-hmm. That was something.
Yeah. And particularly your eye makeup, because you are known for your exquisitely beautiful, large almond-shaped eyes, and all of this 1960s eye makeup that you were wearing really emphasized that being your signature look.
Yeah, I was pretty floppy about it, too, when I think about it. Nowadays, maybe it's because of my age, but makeup artists can take 2 hours to be ready for a start. Well, I'm sure that's a lot to do with my age, but at the time, when, you know, when I was 16 and 17, it would draw the eyelashes on and paint my face. It was like just what I did before I went out in the morning. Yeah. And until the sort of early 1970s, I think, we never had makeup artists. We opened it ourselves.
It's interesting. I hope you can maybe talk a little bit about some of your personal relationships, if you're open to this, because in A Piece of My Heart, at the age of 17, Ari becomes involved with the character of a very famous fashion photographer whose name was Bill Ramsey in the book. But your own relationship with fashion photographer David Bailey began when you were 18 or 19. Are you open to talking a little bit about your own personal experience in terms of like how you wrote Ari and Bill's relationship in the book?
Yes. Well, that was one of the major themes that I wanted to explore, you know, when I kept looking back over the years that I had with Bailey, it was constantly changing in my mind. And I wanted to grips with it, try and understand what was going on. And I think for me, what happened is that I just fell madly in love with him at first sight. I was working as the reader in a publishing company in London as an intern. It was my summer job, even though I'd done some modeling. I also was really interested in writing. So I had this job, and at a party one evening, I met the editor of British Vogue, and she invited me to come in during my lunch hour. I was ushered into her door, and there was this guy sitting on the floor, cross-legged, going through contact sheets. And our eyes locked, and he just like immediately scrambled to his feet. And I just had this moment of total recognition. I felt like I knew him. And I also was very, very sort of attracted to him immediately. But the problem was, A, he was 30 and I was 18. B, or 17 actually at the time. And well, B, and more importantly, he was married. And not only that, he had a mistress. I mean, so I thought, well, that's just, you know, that's not on. Even though I did it with him and the attraction was like very clear. And we had a sort of interesting encounter. Nonetheless, I went back to America thinking, I don't know how it happened tomorrow or in a few years time, but I know we'll be together. And then a few months later, we were.
How did that come to be? Means you were separated by an ocean.
And he came to New York to sort of suss me out, as it were. Then, and my mother answered the doorbell. And when she saw him, she tried to push the door into his face, you know, to close it. And he put his toe of his Cuban heel boot into the door before she could close it. Said, don't worry, love, it could have been worse. Could have been a rolling stone.
And you definitely, definitely directly stole that for the book.
Yeah, but it wasn't my mother in the book. It was my model agent. And true, it could have been worse. Could have been a rolling stone. But it was very much Bailey. And he was a very strong personality. So he was my first boyfriend. And we had an amazing time together, especially at the beginning. We very in love. And we, you know, traveled a tremendous amount to places that, you know, I never would have gone to otherwise, obviously. India and Nepal and Kashmir, part of India. But Egypt, Turkey, you know, all over Europe. Met all sorts of extraordinary people. It was one constant world. But he was not just magnetic to me. He was magnetic to almost every woman who ever set eyes on him. And that was extremely difficult for me because I was very jealous. And he's also working with the most beautiful women in the world. And they're all kind of in his thrall as well. And so even though feminism was sort of just starting up at the time, just the first Gloria Steinem and Betty Friedan and so many people were, and of course, Germaine Greer in the UK, they were all doing fantastic work. But I couldn't really embrace the sisterhood because of all these women throwing themselves at him. You know, and it became more so as time went on.
Dress listeners, did you know that you can save on everything from fashion to beauty, home decor to groceries, even kids' school supplies with Rakuten?
Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. Beauty, clothing, electronics, home, department stores, pets, you name it. You're already shopping at your favorite stores, so why not be saving while doing it? It really is a no-brainer.
How does it work, you ask? Well, stores pay Rakuten a commission for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the commission with its members. You get paid via a check or PayPal quarterly.
Membership is free and it's easy to sign up. So join the 17 million members who have already saved at their favorite brands. Start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up. That's Rakuten.com.
Dress listeners, whatever your reason for wanting to learn a new language, whether it's an upcoming international adventure, communicating with your friends and family abroad, or even professional purposes, Rosetta Stone has got you covered.
As the trusted expert in language learning for 30 years now, you can join millions of Rosetta Stone users to learn any of the 25 languages offered. That includes Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, and so many more.
And this is fast language acquisition, friends. There are no English translations, so you learn to speak, listen, and think in your new language. And right now, you can get lifetime access to all 25 of Rosetta Stone's language courses for 50% off. That's language learning for 25 languages for the rest of your life, which, Cass, is frankly amazing.
It is. And what are you waiting for, dress listeners? Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, I mean, during the 1960s, you and David were in so much demand, both professionally as a model and a photographer, but also socially as an it couple. And I'm sure you have hundreds of stories about the people and the parties. So was your social circle at this time? And are there perhaps a couple of amusing anecdotes that you might want to share with our listeners?
Well, we had a very wide social circle, I'd say. That was the really great thing about London in the 60s. For the first time, all people from the East End, like Bailey, you know, and Liverpool and, you know, working class and aristocracy and establishment and artists of all kinds were coming together for the first time. And it was like every night there was 10 parties that you could go to and all, you know, fun and thrilling. But the first day that I lived with Bailey, which was in 1958, in April, I think I burned all my bridges and left New York. Nobody was speaking to me, of course. My parents were really furious. And my friends, I sort of was so in love that I kind of really, I think I blew it with a lot of people. But anyway, I arrived in England, and the first day that I lived with Bailey, we went down to the East End. So being American, I had no idea who the Great Twins were, but they were the sort of crime lords of the East End. And I had no idea what they did or whatever. It just seemed like we were going back into the early 1950s somehow, with this pub, lots of kind of men with split back hair and tiny suits. And I was ushered up into the sort of ladies' lounge with all these girls who were sort of smoking and drinking and like crazy at about 12 o'clock. And we spent quite some time with the Cray twins, who were arrested about 3 months later. And when I read about what they'd been up to, including murders and whatever, I was completely shocked. Anyway, so that was my first skirmish with Bailey. I think a few months later, we were in Paris for the, you know, to do a job, and we got into a terrible row at Regine nightclub at about 3 o'clock in the morning. We were over a girl, of course, the third, you know, I don't even want to go into it, but clearly Bailey was very attracted to this girl. And so I like pulled him out of the nightclub, and we rowed all the way home. And there was all this people running down the streets. I thought it was some sort of like, you know, festival going on. There was fireworks going off and I don't know, like lots of sounds, whistling rockets and things. It was only the next day that we found out that we'd driven through Paris riot of 1968.
Not a celebration at all.
Not a celebration. In fact, one of the biggest sort of, you know, demonstrations and riots that's ever been in Paris. And yeah, we were oblivious. We were in our own little narcissistic bubble, let's put it that way.
Well, I mean, I can see how it would be very easy to do so, because the fashion world is very kind of insular in that way. That was more your social life at that time, but I would also kind of pose the same question to you on the professional front. Are there any specific fashion shoots or professional moments that really remain impactful with you today?
Well, certainly working with Richard Avedon, Polly Melvin, Ara Gallant was definitely a highlight, because they were all geniuses in their own way. And they were very, very encouraging of me. And I never really felt like I was accepted in that way, you know, and I just felt very inspired by them. Also by Vreeland. She was such great company, first of all. She was a great encourager, not just of me, but of so many people, you know, young people who she governed and also, you know, encouraged and put into business. I just felt very, very lucky to have known them, and who have started out my career with them.
Yeah. And fellow models of this period as well. I'm guessing that the character of Vivara is actually Verushka.
Wonder what would make you think that. Yes.
You know, so in the novel, you do not shy away from some of the very grim realities of the modeling world. There's mentions of like sexual predation and also eating disorders. Would you share some of your own experiences, perhaps on those fronts? And I'm also curious how much you think that things truly have changed for models today, if at all.
Okay, well, I just had a very, very unfortunate experience. Again, when I was 13, a lot of things happened to me when I was 13 because I was on a Greyhound bus. I was going from my boarding school, which was near Boston, to a friend's boarding school in Vermont. And it was winter and all the windows were steamed up. There was hardly anybody in the bus and I was in the back. And some guy got on and he made a beeline for me. And even though obviously I was in a bus and I screamed my head off, I couldn't scream. I couldn't hardly move. He really, you know, he did a number on me that was very scary. It was a sexual assault. But the thing is that at the time, nobody was talking about things like that at all. Nobody was talking about sexual assault. First of all, I felt very ashamed that it had happened. I felt like it was my fault. And second, which I think is very normal. A lot of people seem to think that when it happens to them. But most of all, I was afraid of losing my freedom. I thought that, you know, I was given this sort of, you know, favor of being able to travel on my own at the age of 13. So I didn't tell anybody. And I compartmentalized it totally. And I thought, well, I'm very lucky. Actually, nothing really terrible happened, even though it was very traumatic. And I was at this boarding school I didn't like, was very unhappy there. And about a year later, I sort of just stopped eating. And I lost a lot of weight. I don't think that I wasn't overweight, particularly overweight. Maybe, it, you know, puppy fat sort of thing. But I became incredibly skinny. And weirdly enough, I just got rewarded for it. You know, I got a lot of attention, like positive attention for being skinny. And I managed to sort of ended up fainting. So I decided I didn't want to go to hospital no matter what. I didn't want to lose control that I had of, you know, just controlling what I ate. I weighed myself every single morning. So I gained an ounce or whatever. I stopped eating that day. And it went on like that for years. So yeah, I was rewarded. Being skinny, very, very skinny, obviously was in vogue at the time and it still is. But then I think it really backfired a few years later because I had this hormonal attack of acne, which was probably to do with having starved myself for years and been on all these crash diets.
And then in the novel, it's one of the most poignant and personal details that you imbue with the character of Ari, not just what you said, but also the fact that her career was really interrupted by this sudden onset of this skin condition.
I'm just saying that, you know, I literally lost faith.
Well, and this brings up this very fickle nature of the fashion world and how it really consumes its talent. Women's bodies are always in a constant state of flux. So how did this moment, and this is in the early 1970s, I think, if I'm correct, how did this moment play out in your own journey in the modeling world?
Oh, well, that was the end of my career. And really nobody in the fashion industry. I had lots of friends outside the fashion industry who stuck by me completely. Fashion industry pretty much kind of turned their backs on me. Mrs. Reland still was a friend and at the time, but then we reconnected a bit later on and we were friends until she died. So that was great. But basically it sort of caused the end of my relationship with Bailey. And that was terribly, terribly difficult because to imagine that the person that you think loves you only because you look a certain way.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely.
Pretty devastating.
And you were still pretty fairly young at the time, too, it must be said. He was your first boyfriend. Those relationships early on are so formative and we don't always know how to contextualize them, I would say. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Looking for another history podcast that explores art and design from around the globe? Well, check out The Art of Crime, a history podcast about the unlikely collisions between true crime and the arts.
The latest season is titled Queen of Crime, Madame Tussaud and the Chamber of Horrors, and it chronicles the career of the real Madame Tussaud, kicking off in pre-revolutionary Paris and wrapping up in Victorian London. It also charts the evolution of the Chamber of Horrors, a showroom where Tussaud displayed effigies of notorious criminals.
Did you know that wax modeling was used to study human anatomy for centuries? How about that Tussaud's wax museum played a crucial role in the outbreak of the French Revolution? Or that Tussaud made a bust of Napoleon by coating his face in plaster and sticking straws up his nose so that he could breathe?
As you follow Tussaud from Paris to London, you'll learn why women dominated the business of wax modeling in England, what it was like to travel in a 19th century stagecoach, and how Tussaud got swept up in one of the most heated Victorian debates about the ethics of capital punishment. Subscribe to the Art of Crime podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
I had to understand that there was another world beyond the world of appearances, and that I'd always felt very much as if there's some, I had a spiritual connection with, okay, I don't know how to say it, but without sounding pretentious or weird, what happened with the skin eruption, it forced me to look deeper into myself than I had really, you know, all through my adolescence. And I had to grow up, and that was a good thing.
Yeah. And exiting this world of fashion, as you did, opened up all these other doors for you to pursue other interests as well. What came next for young Penelope? And I'm curious if you have any kind of like big, broad, general life lessons that you learned thus far in your rather extraordinary life that you might want to share with our listeners.
Well, very much always looking beyond the world of appearances to what's going on inside you. I think the problem for me was that I was with this very strong man who knew exactly where he was going. I was quite young and not really formed as a person, and I gave up my center of gravity for him, or to him. And, you know, he literally kind of, he was the one who doing everything, was creating, and he was making our lives work and tick. I really didn't know anything. It was like he was a substitute for my parents in a way. So I went from one home, you know, parental guidance, but, you know, parentally guided. And then I went into another house, which was also quite sort of strict in its own way. And so I had to learn how to be free and look into my psyche and figure out what it was I really wanted to do. And it took some time. And I think that it wasn't until I met His Holiness the Dalai Lama that I suddenly saw that I wanted to look into Buddhism and what that meant for me. And that took a long time too. It didn't happen overnight. I just feel it's given me a great deal of gifts. Brilliant is probably the key word.
Yeah, absolutely. You still model though, occasionally. Photo shoots and runways are still part of your world. How would you characterize your relationship with fashion now, and maybe even your lifelong relationship to fashion?
Yeah, well, I got off. I was bucked off the horse and got back on again. Decided to do that much later when I sorted out my relationship with that whole period of my life, which I did through writing the book. And that was just so helpful because I wouldn't have been able to talk about the whole skin outbreak and my relationship with Bailey, you know, maybe 20 years ago. But it was only writing about it and going through catharsis of reliving some of these experiences that I've been able to kind of, in a way, not exactly get rid of those experiences, not at all, but they're no longer bothering me. And I feel like maybe I hope that they're useful to somebody, hearing about the fact that you can get through these things and out the other side. And there's a much more interesting world out there. But yeah, I mean, I live in the country now. I live pretty much in jeans and sweaters and stuff. But I love reading about fashion and looking at collections and stuff. I don't think that's ever going to be different. I love the texture of them, three of designers, and they're artists. And, you know, I did a show with Valentino a couple of years ago, and all the Valentino seamstresses were there on site. There was 100 models, and, you know, they were having to do a lot of last minute sewing. And I mean, God, these women were just toast. And, you know, up close, I just have so much respect for them. And for the couturiers, they are great art.
Yeah, we talk about it time and time again on the show. It's like, yes, the artistic director of a couture house or a fashion brand is moving things in a certain direction creatively, but oftentimes people don't realize like all the technicians that are actually part of that team as well. It's a massive team.
Massive. Huge teams. And what I like most about working in fashion, working in teams, in great teams. You know, and time and again, that seems to happen. That, you know, I did a few jobs last year, and you find yourself in this very disparate group beginning of the day. You think, oh my God, this is so, you know, how is this ever going to work? And by the end of the day or the time that you had together, you're all like best friends and you so much together. And you have to talk, because when you're doing hair and makeup, talk hair and makeup artist, then you talk to the other model and photographer, and then suddenly, you know, you're in a whole new world. And I love about working.
Well, Penelope, thank you so much for opening up the doors to all of us to peep into your world vis-a-vis A Piece of My Heart.
Oh, thank you so much.
Penelope, thank you so much for joining us to chat about your novel, A Piece of My Heart, as well as your own life and modeling career. Listeners, again, add this to your summer reading list, and you're going to find a link to do so in our show notes. Unfortunately, this distributor of the title doesn't work with our bookshop.org, so we wouldn't be able to post it on our Dressed bookshelf, as this happens from time to time. So there is a link in the episode description. As always, we love hearing from you. So if you'd like to write to us, you can do so by emailing us at hello@dressedhistory.com. You can also DM us on Instagram at @dressed_podcast, which is where we post images to accompany our episodes.
I think that does it for us today, dress listeners. May you consider the it girls in your life next time you get dressed. Can't get enough dressed? Well, we can help you with that. Cassidy's class, What Women Wore to the Revolution Part 2, is currently under session, but you can find more information and still register at dressedhistory.com. Dressedhistory.com is where you can also find more information about my Fashion History Fridays at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City, which I do every Friday. They're super fun. We do the Met's Permanent Collection, and we look at 10 very, very fashionable artworks throughout history, starting in the ancient world all the way up to pop art. So join me if you can. Also, did you know that you can listen to the show ad-free? For just $3 a month, you can subscribe to the exclusive content version of Dress, which does not have ads. Link in our show notes as well there.
Thank you, as always, for tuning in. More Dress coming your way on Friday. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.